Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless, calling, calling home.
Welcome to episode 40 of our Planet Earth series, in which we look at our home planet and those who are studying our home planet. Well, Shoaib Iqbal, I'm not sure I pronounced his name wrong, sorry, is here in the studio with us. He's from ESPA, Satellite Imagery, and we're going to have a chat about what he does. So, welcome to the Space Show.
Thanks for having me.
What is the aim of your company, ESPA Satellite Imagery?
At ESPA, we're building hyperspectral sensors to take images of the Earth on a daily basis. Now, with these images, we're basically looking to collect climate data of the Earth and basically supply that to industries which are working with agriculture, mining, and even beyond into like oil and gas and a lot of other industries as well. So basically the tagline that I use to describe ESPA is that we're delivering climate data from space for industrial efficiency on Earth.
So what sort of services do you aim to provide for your customers?
We're a raw data provider, and with data I specifically mean satellite imagery. We're building the imaging systems ourselves, and then we're capturing this raw data from satellite platforms that we're working with our partners with, and then selling this imagery data to analytics companies, to mining companies, who then utilize it further to derive intelligence out of it.
So you're not aiming to analyze it yourselves?
That's right. There's a lot of partners that we're already working with, and they have a lot of their own specialty, so we're trying to be more generalist from an infrastructure point of view.
So in general, what are the activities of your clients?
So we've been working with a number of companies who are looking at nutrients in agriculture. So we're basically being able to tell how much protein or carbohydrates are in a certain crop, all the way being able to tell how much nitrogen or potassium is in the soil. We're also working with a number of mining companies who are looking at excavating nickel and gold, for example. Specifically, we're looking at rare earth metals, mainly because they're powering what we call them green metals, because they're powering our modern day electronics all the way to battery technology with lithium and cobalt and those sort of things. And thirdly, we're looking at carbon sequestration. So we know that Earth observation totally, it cannot be a golden bullet for tracking all of this data, but we're looking to be a data source in this much larger problem of tracking carbon emissions as well as carbon that's actually being sucked down back into the Earth.
So how many employees or partners do you have?
Currently, our team is around 8 people. Around 3 of us are full-time, and the rest of them are part-time engineering talent that we're working with.
And what are their skill sets?
So my personal skill set is in space science and space operations specifically. So I've been designing high-powered rocket payloads all the way to constellations as well. But my CTO, he's a mechanical engineer, and the rest of the team is split between software and mechanical optomechanics.
Okay. And you're a startup company.
That's right.
So where did you get your funding from?
We raised a family and friends round, I think, about a year ago. And along with that, we've also received grant funding from the AMGC, which is the Advanced Manufacturing and Growth Center, which is the federal government's arm to fund commercialization activities. And they basically doubled the amount of money we had in that. It's also funding the launches that we're currently working towards.
Mm-hmm. And I've read about a mission called Over the Rainbow. And you're involved in that?
That's right. That's our flagship mission. That's something that we're working towards to launch 2 of our hyperspectral sensors. We're working with a number of partners such as Spiral Blue as well as Dandelions in a much larger project called Project Rainbow Python that has been funded by the AMGC. Over the Rainbow is to play a major role in that.
And so what role does Spiral Blue have?
They're building the computing systems for our cameras. So they're building the main payload computer for the camera we're working with, but then they're also building the software systems that run on those computers to reduce the size of the hyperspectral data that we generate. Like traditionally hyperspectral data, because we are looking at, you know, hundreds of wavelengths, and that means literally hundreds of images, that is 100 times that data. To downlink that is very expensive. So we're partnering with Spiral Blue to condense that data down to do some of that analysis on board the spacecraft, which we call edge computing. And they're helping us there by basically reducing all of that cost and making the data more accessible.
And what about Dandelion?
Dandelions are working on new material technology, specifically to be tested in space. So they're partnering on this project with us to essentially see, once we build out our future flagship satellites, whether the material that they're currently testing in space can be used for those, which will be much more lighter and more cost-effective.
And what advantages does what you're aiming to do provide to Australia?
Within an Australian context, with the imagery that we're looking to provide, we're looking to do a bunch of coastal monitoring, and basically looking at algal blooms and looking at larger water bodies, looking for, you know, pollutions in those water bodies, all the way to looking at more terrestrial activities within agriculture specifically, like the nutrition activities that I mentioned before. Those can only be done with the type of imagery that we're providing, and this type of imagery has. There's probably only been a handful of satellites that have even gotten close to providing this. Not to say that we're, you know, doing something completely revolutionary. It's just that the scale that we're trying to do it is very novel.
You mentioned tracking greenhouse gases. In what way are you different from MethaneSat?
We're very similar to them in that sense. We've actually been working with a couple of customers who currently utilize their data. What we've actually found is that one company, or at least the number of satellites they currently have, well, they've recently launched six more satellites, which is congrats to them. But even with those, the amount of revisits that you need, the amount of how the frequency you want to be tracking that cannot be fulfilled by their current capabilities alone, which is why their customers are actually looking for more data providers to be filling in those gaps where GSGSat has not been able to fill. That's where we see ourselves playing as well. And when it comes to GSGSat, they are very North American focused, but oil pipelines and natural gas pipelines don't just exist in North America. Like, I grew up in the Middle East. That's where, you know, Middle East is basically, it's an oil economy. And the same thing goes for, you know, some geographies in Australia as well. So the rest of the world is a huge underserved market when it comes to, you know, tracking these types of emissions. And that's also something that we want to be, you know, I guess, helping track, essentially.
New Zealand, of course, is building a ground station, a ground centre for analysing the data from MethaneSat and, more primarily, a MethaneSat, I understand. Is that something somewhere where your data could go to?
Absolutely. As our positioning is as a data provider, anyone who sort of, you know, wants to access that data is completely open to. And whether it be those the ground station there, or whether it be, you know, other customers that we're currently working with, whether it be them, that's something that, you know, we're trying to. I wouldn't say we're democratizing that data, because that's, you know, a lot of EO companies have already done a lot of work before us to do that. But we're, you know, adding this newer dimension on top of that data to actually, I guess, see what was previously unseen.
You mentioned the Middle East. I remember flying along the Gulf more years ago than I care to admit. And this is at night. Mm-hmm. And the whole interior of the aeroplane for hours was lit up by the orange glow from burning the methane at the oil refineries. Is that still the case, or do they now package up the methane and sell it?
I think I haven't been to the Middle East in a while now as well, but currently the trends are, because methane is a resource, it is essentially natural gas. That's, you know, what's powering the stoves in our house all the way to the heating that we currently have. It is still an important resource, and it is now, you know, harvested and sold. But even in that process, it's not super efficient, especially when you're, you know, working with tons and tons of emissions all the way to looking at, you know, miles and miles of pipeline. And, you know, leakages there and, you know, inefficiencies there can actually cost you millions of dollars in the resource that is methane, while obviously, you know, polluting the atmosphere. That's one of the business cases that we found while, you know, we're tracking, you know, the emissions from a more, not a selfless view. Like, there is a business case that is backing up us doing an activity that is for the greater good.
Okay. I've read about earth tones. What's that?
Earth tones is essentially a platform where you can actually go and buy our data, or currently as it stands, it's a pre-order platform that we've set up. And that's mostly for, I guess we've built it to track the demand for our data currently, while as we currently build our satellites, look at, you know, what type of applications are being requested for the type of imagery data that we'll be generating that we don't know yet. Like, we've actually had quite a, you know, interesting use cases come through, all the way from tracking and counting different species of plants in South India, all the way to, I think recently I was reading a mining company that reached out to us who are based out of Chile. So through that, we were actually, you know, speaking to a number of customers who would usually go under the radar, don't really know a lot about how Earth observation can currently help them, especially from a satellite platform. So that's sort of putting, I guess, a fishing net out there to have a lot of these type of customers and a lot of these type of businesses actually look for the type of data that they're providing and, you know, connect with us directly.
Now, satellites have been photographing the Earth, mapping Earth resources and things since 1972, well, the military even before that, the Landsat satellites, for example. In what way are your satellites different from all those earlier ones?
So from the Landsat generation all the way to, I think, what's, you know, incumbent right now with the WorldView satellites and even the current Landsat and Sentinel satellites, they are multispectral satellites, which means that they only have maybe up to tens of bands, which means the tens of wavelength ranges that they're currently looking at. We're building hyperspectral satellites. So that goes beyond tens of bands to hundreds of them. The first two over the rainbow launches that we're looking at, those are basically 100 bands from 400 nanometers, which is blue wavelengths, all the way to 1,000 nanometers, which is just after the red wavelength and touching the infrared wavelength. There's a lot of data between those wavelengths that actually gets lost if you're just looking at maybe, you know, 10 colors between that. And basically slicing those colors up more gives us much more data points to play with. That allows us to actually track, you know, track the applications that I talked about. It allows us to track methane emissions. It allows us to track carbon sequestration, or, you know, at least get to indicators of those things. And it's essentially that's what we're currently looking into unlock. There are currently a couple of hyperspectral satellites that do similar things, but a lot of them are non-commercial. We're looking to be one of the first commercial players that actually provide this type of imagery data.
I remember in the 1980s, New Zealand developed a multispectral meter, if you like. It wasn't a camera as such. You could select channels. And it flew twice on the space shuttle in the 1980s. And you've obviously taken that sort of technology a lot further.
That's right, where a lot of it has definitely been made possible because of, I guess, where modern electronics currently are. We're currently working with a lot of off-the-shelf technology, and we've been able to basically build those into hyperspectral sensors. Like, our first prototype, and we just started building this, was basically a modified DSLR camera, which is just something we bought off the shelf. Now, of course, we're working with a lot more specialized equipment, and that's still, you know, much more cost-effective, and that's what I mean by, you know, scaling it much more further, just because that cost has gone down low, and we've obviously there's some things that we've developed on our end from, like, a software point of view as well as a hardware point of view that's making that, you know, scalability a lot more possible.
How many satellites will comprise your initial constellation?
So we're looking to have around 18 satellites by 2025. That does not include the two that are going up next year, so those are just demonstrators. But with these 18 satellites, we're basically looking to image the Earth on a daily basis. There's a lot of challenges around that. Like, there's, you know, cloud cover that we need to think about. That usually drives up the number of satellites. But we're working with specific spectrums in the infrared spectrum that allows us to bypass that. We are specifically looking at shortwave infrared for those 18 satellites, which we call our flagships, where we will be able to see through clouds and be able to not be obstructed by those things, which is what's something that allows us to keep our number of satellites comparatively lower.
And where are you building your satellites?
We're building them here in Melbourne. To be more specific, we're building these sensors in Melbourne within our lab that's in Mulgrave. And then we're working with a number of partners out of the U.S. who are building the much larger satellite, and we're just buying space on those spacecrafts.
Mm. Now, this year's federal budget allocated more than $1 billion. Billion, 10 to the power of 9 dollars, to the Australian Space Agency to develop remote sensing satellites. So would ESPA be a contender for some of that funding?
Absolutely. It was really good news to us when we woke up to it. And I think it was like, actually, we didn't even wake up to it. I was just like about to go to bed when I just opened my LinkedIn and there's this huge announcement of like, 1.2 billion. And I'm like, yo, this is really cool. And definitely that is, we see ourselves, well, currently we might be the only commercial imaging player here, and like we're seeing a lot of, newer upstarts coming up as well. Those things, definitely give us a lot of confidence in terms of how, from a local capability point of view, those things are being developed here. And we do see ourselves being a major competitor as we, mature and as our, technology reaches space heritage. And as we keep on delivering on our own mission, we do want to be, contributing to the local ecosystem of space here as well.
I know that the folks at Melbourne University who are building a satellite also have their eyes on that pot of gold. Okay. Turning to yourself, you studied at Monash College and then RMIT University. Mm-hmm. So please tell us about that.
Yeah, so I moved to Australia, I think, in 2017, right after my high school, year 12. I think at Monash College, I did a diploma of engineering, after which I went to RMIT to pursue a degree in space science. So I am in my final year. I'm going to be done with it soon-ish. And I think in my second year, we ended up starting ESPER. It started off as like a university hackathon project, and we contended the UniHack 2019, and after which we ended up winning, and we were like, hey, this idea might actually have some legs, let's try to build it into a business. And that was 3 years ago now, and since then, obviously, we've been building, and now we've gotten closer to launch, and we have some funding that's backing us up there, and I'm also almost done with my degree too.
I remember I first became aware of you when you did a TEDx talk for Monash.
That's right.
That was fun.
Yeah, it was, it was a really good experience. I remember, I think it was in 2018 when they launched the local TEDx chapter, and I was like, hey, that's really cool. And the next year we were working on the company, and I was like, that would be a great opportunity to actually, put ourselves on that much larger stage and declare to the world, hey, we're building this, and build in public in sorts as well, have that public accountability of us actually delivering what we were working on. And that was sort of like a moment that we've, snowballed from since then.
During your time at Monash, you had a role in the Monash high-powered rocket team. What did you do there?
I was a payload engineer there, and that's actually where a lot of my, interest and a lot of my background in space is started. I basically worked on a lot of imaging systems on some of our payloads, working on some camera systems that we were currently working on. It was a lot of consumer off-the-shelf stuff, just by, Raspberry Pi cameras and those sort of things. But then there was obviously the mechanical engineering challenge of making it survive the 8-9 Gs that it goes through on that high-powered rocket system there. I think with Monash high-powered rocketry, I built up to maybe a level 2 rocket, complete with entire deployable payloads and all those sort of things that I had a part in. It was a really fun experience. I think the team's really evolved since then. I think they're currently in the U.S. for Spaceport America, for the Spaceport America Cup. Really looking forward to how they actually end up going.
Okay. And you also are not a stranger to a radio studio.
Absolutely.
What did you do there?
So yeah, I was at Radio Monash. I did two podcasts just like as a presenter myself. The first one that I did, we called it Hustler, which was, I guess, my foot in the door of like the startup ecosystem in total, where I just like talked about a lot of startups. And, you know, I sometimes had my old co-founders come in and we would just, you know, talk about our companies that failed. And those were pretty cool. And I think the semester after that, me and my other mate, we just sort of had a bit of a, I wouldn't call it a comedy show, but it was just like us talking about random stuff that's happened over the last week. Mostly it just helped to build a lot of confidence, you know, putting your voice out there for hundreds of people to listen to, which was at first really terrifying, but I've obviously gotten used to it. Alongside with that, it's helped the radio basically go from, I think it was in its renaissance at that point. Now it's obviously grown into something that's the university is pretty much fully funding it themselves. But at that point, we were pretty small and we were basically kick-starting back up to, I guess, the growth that they've seen over the last couple of years.
Hmm. Well, back to ESPA. What are your hopes for the future of ESPA satellite imagery?
With ESPER, we're currently you know, starting off with measuring a lot of metrics around the Earth. Our focus currently is, you know, from a climate point of view, measuring those climate metrics, supplying this climate data to businesses who are basically looking to change and looking to modernize to not, you know, hurt the planet anymore. But beyond that, we're looking to not just measure those things, but we're looking to measure the entire physical world when we get to that point. And of course, that looks beyond just satellite imagery. That looks at multiple different data sources. But we see ourselves being this huge data infrastructure company that is, you know, have, I guess, you know, again, going to that measuring the physical world point, measuring all of these different metrics to, you know, supercharge every type of business activity, because I guess there's a cliche term that we use in the satellite imagery industry is that, you know, what gets measured gets managed.
Well, we wish you all the best.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us on the Space Show.
Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless.